Programming Throwdown, episode 179, Project Planning. Take it away, Jason.
Hey, everybody. It is so fun to actually do these duo shows, I have to say. I think the interviews, were super lucky that we could get such a multidisciplinary set of talented people to do interviews. And I appreciate everybody reaching out. We get many, many requests to interview.
Yeah, we do. We get a lot.
Yeah, we get. I get a ton in my personal email too that you don't even see.
Oh, really?
You get a lot in your personal email?
Nope.
Yeah, see, mine's too available. So we really appreciate it. I mean, we're honored that so many people want to be on the show, but it's just really fun, just the two of us talking about tech stuff. So we're gonna keep it like this for a little while. And I will kick us off with store that we opened. So or I say by we, now I'm talking about my wife and I, and really by we I mean my wife opened. I did a lot of the manual labor, but we opened it's called Bricks and Minifigs. It's a franchise, and it's basically an event space and a retail space. So on the retail side, they sell Lego. They sell bricks and minifigs, as it suggested, sets and all of that. They also have a thing where you can build your own minifigure. And then it's also kind of like a clearinghouse for Lego. I didn't realize this was a thing, but people will want to sell their Lego, right? Which makes sense after they built it and played with it. The thing that surprised me was there's a huge audience of people who want to buy already built Lego.
Whoa.
Yeah, that
I did not know that.
Not expecting. And now that the store is up, you see it every day. Like, I'll be in the store building some furniture or something, and someone will say oh, that would look really good on our coffee table. And they just buy it as if they're at an art gallery or something. And a lot of these people actually don't want to build it. They actually just want to have it. So really surprised at that. Now, the other part of the business, which is honestly the part that really I like the most, is the event space. So we do birthday parties, all different other kind of corporate events and stuff, and people build Lego. We have actually this cool racetrack where there's a metal car, a metal chassis of a car that has the Lego studs on it, and so you build a car and try and race it down the track, kind of Pinewood Derby style.
Nice.
I guess beyond just shilling the store for the 1% of listeners who happen to be in Texas, I want to talk a little bit about career breaks. So, I basically took a career break, and I actually, did a lot of side projects and things like that, but I also helped my wife kind of get the store off the ground. And it was awesome. I mean, I know that this is thing that might not be accessible to everybody, but if you could take a short break, and especially if you've been in the industry 10, 15, 20 years, it's really nice to just instead of I was always the type of person where if I decided I wanted to change jobs, I would still keep working really hard at my current job until I found the next thing, and then I would leave a 1 day gap or something between the first job and the second job. This time, having a longer gap is really, really nice, especially if you've been in the industry for a long time. I highly recommend it.
People talk about, I guess maybe it used to be more common, maybe it was never more common. I don't really know, but sabbaticals.
I
don't really know what goes into a sabbatical, but first of all, congratulations. Tough thing to do. So good luck.
Thanks.
I won't quote all the statistics about new businesses to you, but I'm just teasing. It helps that
there's not default who's a person who Paul Graham, he says, startups are default dead until they're profitable. But in our case, we don't really have to be profitable. It's just really a fun thing for the community. So I think that ups our survival rate.
There you go. Unintentional nonprofit. I'm sorry. I'm just teasing. No, best wishes. I think taking a career break, change of things is actually a good advice. And there's a lot of nuance, not to derail like into this for very long, but just if you're planning to leave a position, just look at like what the rules are around most places. Your insurance coverage is a concern, so people don't want gaps because of insurance. But in a lot of places, once the first of the month hits, your insurance is basically paid for the month by your company and your premium. So if you stop on the second of the month or whatever, you're actually covered for the rest of the month. And so you could take, you know, a 4-week break basically and, you know, have insurance coverage without any gap. Now, again, you should please like read that. That's not something you really ask your manager, right? Because then you're kind of admitting you're leaving. But for something that if it's helpful to plan for and plan around, it can ease some of the stuff that make it a little more accessible, I would say, to take a little bit of a gap. And then you can also, in many positions in tech, you can negotiate a signing bonus to help cover that. And that's not necessarily always obvious or offered, but you can always ask for, hey, you know, I'm gonna take this. I'm convincing my spouse or whatever. I need a little bit of help to take a vacation in a, you know, in between, or say whatever excuse, you know, helps it in your head. If negotiating is hard for you, to try to ask for a little bit more of a signing bonus, and your negotiating power, you know, starting the new job. But I do agree, taking time to do something off. People talk about online. I've never done it. I kind of envy it, but it's like an early retirement, like a mini retirement. We kind of wait till the very end of our careers and then we retire and never work again. That's at least the sort of stereotypical thing.
Yep.
There's no reason why you couldn't save money, take a year, then return to work. And for many people, returning isn't that hard after a year. You know, it is very situational and person dependent, and compounding of money, you know, does make, there is slight problem to the hand wavy. It doesn't make a difference, but if it allows you to come back to work with new freshness, new eyes and new vigor and energy, I would argue there's compounding returns from that as well in your job performance and how people are happy. So I think totally. Taking a break is great advice.
Yeah, totally. I would say a couple of things based on what you said. One is there's this thing called COBRA, which is probably just an American thing, but there's probably equivalents in other parts of the world where you get your employer's insurance for an extra year after you've left. Now, you have to pay for it, but at least you don't have to like change all your doctors and all of that stuff. So that is an option. It's also kind of interesting. You have the option of retroactively getting COBRA. So for example, you could say like, oh, you know, I'm just going to go without insurance for 6 months. And then, oh, you break your arm. You can actually sign up for COBRA like after they've fixed up your arm and everything. And they'll retroactively like recalculate all of your medical expenses, which is pretty wild. I mean, it's actually kind of remarkable just from a tech standpoint that they can do that. And then the other thing I was going to say, you know, I think it's important to have some kind of a goal. You know, I actually told people when I was leaving my last job, they said, oh, what are you doing next? And I had it ready to go. I was like, here's what I'm doing. I'm going to help my wife build a retail store. And so it's like, I think having a plan, you know, helped a lot. I feel like if you just veg out for a while, that's fine. That's a different kind of career break than saying, I'm going to like hike a mountain or travel the world or whatever. And if you're going to have some kind of focus, then you should plan it all beforehand, because you don't want to waste your time not getting paid planning. You know, that's time where you could be doing that on the nights and weekends while you work your job, you know.
You're not working the nights and weekends?
You know, I almost never work weekends unless things are really wrong. I will work a lot during the week, but I will not work a weekend unless I absolutely have to.
Yeah, unless it's just like a really quick statement or whatever. By default, if someone is saying anticipating that I need to do it, then they've needed incorrectly, I guess. I try to do that for, you know, the people that I help on the teams and stuff as well. It's like, we shouldn't plan that the work needs, you know, more than the normal working hours.
Yeah. I don't know if you feel this way, but I get more and more energy as I work. So like by 5 p.m., like I'm really, really excited about work. And then by, you know, let's say 8 a.m. the next day, it's like I have to kind of like start the train again. And I've been this way my whole life. Like it's not an age thing. Even when I was 20 years old working, I still had this mentality. And so it's like I would rather work a ton of hours on Friday than like come in on Saturday and work for 4 hours and get pretty much nothing done. So, you know, it's like, you know, that I feel like that works a lot better.
No, I don't share that trait. I think everyone's different, and I think we can get into that when we talk about planning for projects, but that's different true. People have different ways of reacting to things. All right, well, I think it's time for the planning. News. Oh, sorry.
All right, what is your news, Patrick?
My first topic was an interesting, I don't even know, these show up, you know, on social media, like sometimes you see them on like X or on Reddit or wherever, and someone just like posts this and like a conversation spins up and everyone's talking about it. And anyways, this one was someone had posted a GitHub gist where they put some numbers down, and I can't speak to the veracity, the sort of correctness of these numbers, but they were saying that they were a big contributor on Stack Overflow, and that they were posting these numbers to say that, you know, Stack Overflow number of new questions has been going down. It, of course, sparked an interesting online discussion around it. And so I just bring it up here because I think it is interesting. On the one hand, I don't know. Have you ever, Jason, posted a question on Stack Overflow?
That is itself a great question. I've literally never done that. I've answered questions, but I'm definitely not like a top answer or anything. I've literally never posted a question.
I haven't either. But I have read enough stories, like one of these things, I guess, like in my head, I've built it up to be a thing where, you know, I don't think there's a lot of low effort questions. They get closed. And I think over time, Stack Overflow has gone through curation to try to, you know, get good quality questions asked. And so I think part of it, and you hear the same thing about Wikipedia. I've never edited a Wikipedia article, largely for what I would say is kind of the same reason. You read stories about people who talk about the, you know, over process and the context around what's expected of you if you're going to put, and I just
quick side note, I tried to create a Wikipedia page for this show and it got rejected. This was like 12 years ago or something,
because we weren't noteworthy or what was
they didn't, at the time we didn't have enough news stories about us. At the time we had zero. I probably could make one now, but to your point, it's like once you get rejected, like I put in a lot of time into that,
yeah,
and then it's just gone. I think they literally delete it to where like you just can't even get it anymore, and so it's like who wants to work on Wikipedia after that?
A bit of an aside, and I'm thankful that there are people that do, and they become committed to the idea of I'm going to do this. It's like an iterative thing, right? You get shut down, they submit again, they try something different, they're persistent. And once you get over that hurdle, I do believe like it can be very valuable for you to continue sort of writing articles, submitting things. But if you're just seeing it as like a very transactional, I want to do this one time, I agree. I think the bar in my head at least gets to where I don't attempt it. But I will, that's not where the conversation went. Although I think we should be aware of that. The conversation immediately jumped on, not surprisingly, to everyone's just asking their questions to AI instead. And so there were some points and counterpoints, which is a very interesting discussion about Stack Overflow. Profit has actually stayed up in part because they've been able to license all of these questions and answers to AI training. In some ways, the sort of questions have gone on to those platforms because more than just a search, they've sort of been able to aggregate and combine these, all of the information there into the LLMs that you can then interact with and sort of be more responsive and ask your questions. And then not to get sort of conspiracy, but you get kind of the dead internet theory. Then the problem is, okay, but all of the questions about new languages and this, like how do we get that information out onto Stack Overflow? And so just a very interesting discussion. I don't have a sort of strong held opinion or belief here, but just as the internet sort of rolls forward, I've benefited many times from going on Stack Overflow and sort of seeing questions and response style. It fits very naturally with the kind of work that I do. And so it's very useful. I personally haven't shifted a ton of that over to sort of artificial intelligence, but maybe I will in the future. But then what about the questions about the next libraries and all of that never get posted on Stack Overflow? Over time, does it naturally sort of fade into the sunset and we you know, just go other places. I mean, probably that's a natural course, but an interesting discussion nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your dead internet theory point, it's like when you ask an AI a question, it might be a question that the AI's never thought of before, seen before, but it can piece together an answer from, you know, all the other questions it's seen. The problem is really that that answer is not in Stack Overflow. And so like you're not growing the collective consciousness if the AI just like tells you the answer and then it's deleted.
So maybe the AIs need a blog where like they, when they have these novel thoughts, they're sort of aggregated, collected, and then published, and then the AIs can help the other AIs grow, and it can be, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, you know what's funny is actually when you were saying that, I was like, yes, that's right. I think that actually is where it'll go. I think the AI will, you could do some kind of like novelty detection and say like, oh, if this is a novel question, then we'll post the answer, the question and the answer, maybe on Stack Overflow. So Stack Overflow will have a bunch of questions and answers from AI, and then people can go and correct it and all that.
Yeah, it'll be... Yeah,
I use AI a ton, actually. The other day, I wanted to do... This is a little weird, well, hard to explain, but I wanted to do like 2,000 Gaussian mixture models in parallel. And so I wanted to vectorize it so that I would, without like a for loop, because one thing about machine learning stuff or just, you know, in general, these kind of things, like for loops kill your performance, right? So if you do like 4x from 0 to 1,000, you know, A plus equals X or A plus equals IX, right? So you do that to sum an array. Or you just use like some sum operator on the whole array. The second one's going to be like hundreds of times faster, right? And so I needed a totally vectorized way to do a bunch of Gaussian mixture models. And I asked AI, and I'm fairly confident nobody's asked AI to do this, and it produced an answer, and it was actually totally correct. And so that's the kind of thing that like probably should have somehow made its way into Stack Overflow.
Yeah, I had an opposite experience. I asked a question that it gave me an answer, which was obviously wrong, wrote some sample code, wrote all this stuff. And then I was just like, and I'd even just told it, I was just, I don't know, whatever. Like, that's not right. And it's like, you're correct. I did get it wrong, actually. And then it proceeded to write something else that was actually still incorrect, but at least like closer and less obviously wrong. And I found this like, you know, sort of, you know, diverging off your thing, you know, I it was a very weird mental thing for me to be like, by simply telling it was wrong, it's like, if you had thought longer, would you have given me the second response? Like, couldn't you just tell yourself, like, are you sure? It just is very strange. So it's sort of very different than, you know, going on to Google and searching for a blog post or a Stack Overflow. And so, yeah, I still not long all of the, you know, asking AI the questions, but I do think it's getting better.
Well, that is a great segue to my news story, which is DeepSeek claims its reasoning model beats OpenAI's O1 on certain benchmarks. And so I have an article linked to TechCrunch here. But, you know, what you said is exactly right. And so you can imagine, like, imagine a system where every time you gave it a question, it gave you an answer. And then you said, are you sure that answer looks kind of wrong? And it went through and gives another answer. Now, let's assume that, you know, if you kind of like tell it, okay, so let's assume that creating an answer out of the ether versus creating an answer based off a past answer. So let's assume that the latter is better than the former on aggregate. So like if you have the benefit of this earlier answer and all the computation that went into it, let's assume that you could write a better answer the second time, right? So now that's really interesting because you can actually create training data for yourself as an AI. So an AI could spend twice as long answering a question and then go back and say, hey, that answer that took twice as long, like I want that answer right away. And so it can fix itself, like self-healing kind of stuff. And so this is not a new idea. Like you see this with games. So for example, look at AlphaGo, right? So AlphaGo will use tree search and like simulate future boards, right? And so it might think, oh, this move is good and this move is good. But then it does a bunch of simulations and it finds, oh, only that first move is good. The other one's trash. Well, like that's feedback to the first system that has to make that like snap judgment, right? And so this is taking that idea and bringing it into the large language model space. And so a really interesting idea. Now, the challenge becomes like credit assignment. So, you know, there are times where you say like, hey, think about this more, and it does, and the answer is worse, or it's like more, it's like hallucinates even more and stuff. So you have to craft, you still need to guide the system. As long as you're making this assumption that just like every second answer is better, you know, if you want to relax that or push back on that, now you have to guide the system using reinforcement learning as other tricks. But OpenAI has been working on this for a while. The thing that makes this really interesting is the DeepSeek model comes from a quant finance research lab in China that I think they were, if I get this story correctly, you know, they were like doing quant stuff. And I'm not a finance guy, Patrick, you're probably going to like rip on me for this, but I guess it's like you're buying and selling things at certain times, or I don't know what they're doing. So then all of a sudden they like had to take a break from that. There was some like issue that there was some crackdown or something. And so they started working on some of these other models, and they produced this amazing reasoning model that's completely free, like source code available. The only thing that's not available is the data they use to train the model, which is not uncommon. I think most of these models have that closed data. But the model itself, the weights are free, the source code's free. You can fine tune it. You can do all these things. And so it's really kind of revolutionary. We'll have to see where it goes.
This, speaking of credit, I've lost whose idea this was, not mine. But someone was pointing this out, and I've been intrigued. So you mentioned sort of like AlphaGo. And I think one of the things that was really interesting is initially AlphaGo was trained with sort of, you know, all of the Go games that were online, basically, like these expert games, whatever. Then eventually they said, hey, because there's rules of the game, I think this is the guiding you're talking about. There's a framework for winning and losing, better and worse, which is sort of different from all human knowledge, I guess. And they kind of later said, oh, actually, we've removed all of those games, started again and bootstrapped with just playing each other and just like figuring it all out from scratch without that anchoring. And the, I don't know, thought experiment, the idea people were talking about as like, you know, I think we've sort of moved the goalposts, given up the sort of like, how do we determine if an AI is sort of like AGI, or if it's able to fool a human? Like everything sort of shifts because things kind of became in a way that is different than we kind of thought they would. And so this discussion has been lost. But one of the things someone was saying as like a sort of marker would be, right now we feed tons and tons of data, all of Wikipedia, all of Stack Overflow, all of the internet in as this training data. If instead you sort of went back and said, let's take all of the books and newspapers and research up to, you know, sort of 1900, and then sort of ask questions like, the phenomena were often known for sort of quantum physics or for general relativity, like everything was written where you could, via sort of thought experiment, come up with a lot of these ideas and theories and show that the math worked. And later we sort of back explained things that were happening that either were misascribed or that we didn't know. So could you give one of these models like everything up to in the date, you know, we kind of argue with, but where you have some of these experimental results, you know, kind of lock it and ask it to thought experiment forward sort of physics frameworks? And would you get quantum mechanics? Would you get Einstein's theory of general relativity? Would they be able to sort of self-reinforce, right? And you kind of need almost like what you're talking about, where they would write their own papers. Then they would sort of incorporate those learnings into other learnings, maybe an agentic AI where people are taking different things so they can kind of bounce off each other, whatever the solution is. But I don't think we're there today for two reasons. Like, it seems still all of these models require just gobs and gobs of training data, not very small corpuses. All of the written recorded data up to 1900 is a very tiny fraction of what goes into these today. And then second of all, I don't think there's this ability that, and I, maybe we're getting there with what you're saying, but to kind of roll forward, to let these things sort of have their own simulated society and like roll it forward and discover these things and learn them and understand them. And so, of course, it's even further to say they could run their own experiments. Maybe that's a lot harder and out of reach today. But what I'm describing, just sort of via thought experiments and sort of deep introspective thinking, you know, and then later it gets proven out by experiment, right? But it feels like you could do that if you had the right architecture, system, training, but we're not there today.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that with a lot of these things, it'll end up like it really multiplies the hallucination problem. You know, it's like, I see there's a kernel of truth here that 1 + 1 = 3, but we got to the wrong conclusion. Let's use that kernel of truth and like go a different route. You know, so I think, you know, in general, when you multiply errors, right? When you have a chain of things, you have to multiply the errors. And so what we're missing, I think the big foundational thing we're missing is like we have kind of really strong models in our brain of physics. That's how people can like hit a baseball flying 100 miles an hour, right? It's like we have these like at a really low level, this like primary visual cortex. We have something similar, I'm sure, for audio and for physics, all these things. And they are evolved. So the training data goes back millions of years, right? And so that's, I think, those kind of simulators, you know, we don't really know how to plug that into an AI. Like we're just starting with very basic things like, the AI will decide, oh, what's left here is like an algebra problem. I can use Wolfram Alpha, you know, like, but that's very early days and like using tools and, you know, and having sort of like simulators that aren't kind of here's a very simple experiment you can run to prove this to you. If you take a picture of a maze, even a very simple maze that like any child could solve, and you tell an LLM to draw like an ASCII art version of the maze, like it won't be able to do that. It will completely fail. And I think the reason for that is that you need this kind of simulator where you kind of, as you're drawing, you're then kind of going back and like you have this like concept of spatial that's kind of independent of the language model. And these are all things that are coming, but they're not there yet.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. I have a couple follow-up thoughts, but we won't get stuck here forever or we'll never cover anything else. But the first one is, I think, and again, not original to me, I think Jan LeCun talks about this in some of his interviews, but the sort of world model and the evolution of that. But I sort of have that thing in back of my head is the video generation. If you watch some of the video generation stuff rather than the LLM stuff, they end up needing an understanding, like, you know, I have a picture of a guy holding a ball and I ask you to generate a video of him dropping it, right? Well, how far should the ball drop each frame requires some understanding about physics, about world modeling. What if I throw it up, right? Like, hey, a pitcher is throwing a baseball. Are you going to draw in a sort of parabola, right? Like this up and down that physics is well described, but it doesn't actually, it has gobs of data about people throwing baseballs, but it's never been given the equation for throwing a baseball, you know, that it needs to follow a parabola, half spin, you know, this kind of stuff is really interesting. But then more directly into the DeepSeek thing, I guess, is I did see people posting some of the, you know, interactions with DeepSeek and what you're talking about, the infamous, how many R's are in strawberry? So somebody asked DeepSeek, you know, how many R's are in strawberry? And it gets stuck in this arguing with itself loop. Like, it's like, well, let's list out the letters, S, T, R. Oh, there's one. A, W, it gets to the second R, R, gets to the third R. It's like, uh-oh, there's a mistake. I know there's supposed to be two R's, but I just counted three. Wait a minute, let's try it again. And so it like, it goes again and it tries to go again and again. So like it keeps getting to this, like you said, a kernel, like it's doing the correct thing. It knows how to count, knows how is arguable, but it like, it's doing counting, which is correct. But then it also somehow like has this belief that the answer is two, which, you know, several LLMs seem to have gotten stuck with this for whatever reason, source grounded that strawberry has two R's. And because of that, like it sort of goes, wait a minute, I must have miscounted. I must have done an algorithm I wasn't supposed to do. So then it tries, you know, variance on counting, basically keeps coming up with the answer three and going, but that's wrong. And so it's just this very fascinating, like clearly the answer is three. You could ask anyone, but like it kind of can't do it. It's just this, yeah. It's just this like, oh, it just killed over and died.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, this is like, it needs like a roving eye that can like rove like over all the different letters. And it needs to be able to do that kind of explicitly instead of implicitly, and we're just not there yet.
All right. Well, my next news article is not directly in this, but it is a bit on topic, I guess. And that is a list of computer science papers every developer should read. I'm apologizing. I won't attempt to pronounce the author's name, Dr. Well, I guess I'll try to say the last name. Are you able to say this, Jason, or do you want me to go?
Milan Milanovic.
Okay. I was going to say the same thing, Dr. Milanovic. And he wrote this this blog post, the link's in the show notes. It's a lengthy link. And the papers here listed, I don't, you know, have strong opinions about these specific papers, but he kind of goes into a defense of why developers should read academic papers. Now, I guess this is going to expose a bit of a difference between Jason's practice of computer science and my practice of computer science. But in the kind of work that I do, with largely embedded folks, you know, application programming, reading academic papers it doesn't happen. Most folks probably didn't do it in university. They don't do it now. It's just a foreign thing. And we've talked about this on the show from time to time. But I guess I will say that I think it can be a bit, people overuse it, but a bit of a superpower. If you're in a role where no one reads academic papers and you're willing to at least try to read academic papers when the need arises, going around and saying, oh, there's this new research paper that says, you know, this, and we're going to do it, probably not the right answer. But saying, oh, hey, people must have had this problem before. People must have, you know, worked on this issue. And just doing a literature search is kind of what I would call it, often turns up via academic papers or whatever. And you would be floored at the number of people who won't just search for something. Hey, I'm stuck on this hard problem. I need an optimization of this nature. And they just won't sort of, we're just talking about AI, maybe that'll be the future, but they won't just shove it into Google and try to like spend a few minutes sifting through this. It's not going to give you a Stack Overflow answer, but you might find a paper where someone has looked at that. Hey, optimizations, cache efficiency of various hash map styles, whatever it might be. And so I will agree with the doctor here saying, well, I guess we don't say it that way because that makes it sound like a medical doctor. Anyways, with the author of this blog post and sort of say that I think you should try to read a few papers. I will be honest, whenever I read a paper, 90% of it is just like one ear out the other. Like I either can't decipher what they're saying or can't understand it. But even just reading a few of it, looking at the pictures, start to pick it up. If you do one or two of those, you will start to glean the gist. And then either going and giving you the next thing to go search or writing it. It really is, for certain problems, just such a like 10x ability to kind of like execute on it. And I'm not talking about papers that were written this year or last year in this journal. I'm talking about like 1980s, you know, the, you know, 2000s, that there were these papers written, and you'll find them. And it's just like, wow, that's, yeah, this is great. This is exactly what I needed. Or gives somebody, you know, like, hey, there's backup that I'm not crazy doing this. Like, this is a well thought through thing in some corners of the universe.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, I mean, I've read probably 2 to 3 papers a week for 25 years. So I've read a lot of papers. I've actually read most of the papers you posted, which I feel like is
pretty proud of. Good for you.
Considering like these aren't really my fields per se. Actually, this Out of the Tar Pit sounds really interesting. Folks can check all the show notes on whatever app you're using to listen to the show, the notes should be there. Or you can go to programmingthrowdown.com. But yeah, these papers are amazing, like MapReduce, Bigtable, Kafka. I will say, to read a paper, well, typically it's good to, you know, you read the abstract because it's the first thing. And then I go straight to, I'll read the introduction if I'm not already motivated. You know, the introduction's there to kind of motivate the idea. Depending on kind of like the first few lines of the introduction, I may or may not skip it. But I'll go to the background and see like, okay, is this standing on a foundation that I know? Like if I start reading the background, it's like, we all know about Uyosaka method. And I'm like, uh-oh, like, okay, I guess I have to go read that one. If it seems like I can like more or less understand the background, I'll actually skip the main like contribution of the paper and go straight to the results. And typically in the results, there'll be some other method that I know. And that will really help. Even just knowing what they compared with. Like I'll go straight to the table of the results. It's like, okay, you know, they compared with like several different actor-critic policies. So this must be another actor-critic policy, you know, these kind of things. And then I'll look at the results. And they'll also give me an idea, like, if this is like a 16-page paper and it's like 0.02% better than like some other method, well, you know, it kind of tempers my expectations, right? And then I'll go back and read the method. So you kind of have to like go in that order, I think.
It is a learned skill. I mean, I think like what Jason's saying, I mean, to be fair, I've read maybe 3 to 5 papers a year. that's, I guess maybe I'm going to shame myself, but whatever. it does take time and it is not, at least for me, not just like I'll pick it up and do it. There's a technique to it and you do learn that they're written in a certain way. And, you know, it sometimes does take 2 or 3 in the same sort of corner to kind of get, and then you go back. And I think that's the other thing is it's not like a blog post. You can kind of read it once and get it. I think in my thing, at least you kind of skim it, look at the pictures, kind of get where you're going, and you might go back. And then as you sort of figure it out, you might go back again. And as silly as it sounds, even in this day, like printing it out and for whatever reason, like actually having it in front of me, this is literally the only thing I ever print out anymore, but I will print out a paper if I'm really trying to get through it, and like holding it and sort of like being able to see 2 pages at once or, you know, or mark on something or like, you know, circle something I want to come back to. I never do that for anything else, but when I do papers, it, you know, it helps me.
Yeah. I used to print it out and now I use the e-ink tablet. And then you could just draw with the pencil. Man, I mean, this is okay. We're going into a bunch of side talks here, but it'd be amazing if someone made. Why hasn't someone just made a e-ink tablet that's the size of a U.S. sheet of paper? Like, why is that so hard?
Money?
I will pay for that. You have one person who will buy that. maybe there's some technical thing too. I don't know. Like maybe like making an e-ink tablet that's that big is. Problem.
Yeah, I would also, I mean, I guess like once you add in the other stuff, maybe it's like difficult to fit into your backpack or something, like you know, and so therefore people, I would assume most people buying them are reading fiction, you know, novels, and those fit really well on a relatively small screen and just float, right. Data just flow, the words just flow around, right? I would assume that's, well, whatever, 95% of the hours spent on e-ink tablets are spent doing that, and so I think today they sort of cluster around the size of a paperback.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. There's an amazing thing. If folks, I don't know if this is on iPhone, it probably is, but if you have Adobe Acrobat on Android, they have this thing called Liquid Mode where it takes like the paper and turns it into kind of like that format where you can scale the text and read as, you know what I mean? It basically takes the PDF and turns it into a format that's awesome for mobile. And it usually doesn't mess up the diagrams and all that.
That feels like a low-hanging AI target right there, which is like, take this PDF and make it like, you know, whatever. I don't know what they call that. Yeah, flowable, EPUB. Liquid, like whatever. Yeah. Yeah. But like, good. I've seen so many bad where people, it just like, it's broken and doesn't work right.
Yep. Yeah, same. All right. My article is, my second is NVIDIA Cosmos, an AI platform to change the future of robots and cars, wins best of CES. So, that's a pretty bold subtitle there. But what is that? Anyways, the thing where like you kind of put a title in the middle of a title. But Cosmos is really interesting, and it ties into what Patrick was saying. It is a world foundation model, and so the idea is people at NVIDIA have taken, you know, like videos and tried to predict the future of the video, and they've done other things like that. And what you end up with is something that. The World Foundation model is trying to be kind of like a physics simulator to try to give you like an idea of what's going to happen in the future. And then what you can do is take embeddings, which are like, you know, compressed vector representations of images. You can take like the embeddings of the future and feed them into a model. And so the idea is if you have a robot, the robot might know that, like, hey, you know, this future looks pretty weird. Like, this future looks like it's the kind of future of a robot that's falling down the stairs. And so I'm just going to stop because I don't like where this is going, right? And so the idea is you can combine these world models with like some like inertial data and all of that to like make robotics a lot easier. You know, nothing practical has come out of it. But I think it's something really interesting. And I think that it's skating where the puck is going. I just don't know what's going to happen there.
There were a lot of really interesting, we didn't put them in here, but NVIDIA announcements. So, I mean, I think for sake of time, we'll just skip them. But if you haven't gone and looked at the various things that NVIDIA is doing and introduced, and you're vaguely interested in AI and how the underlying hardware is, you know, shifting, I would definitely go. There's some like, what do they call those? Like supercut, like where they cut up the sort of CEO speech and sort of like show you the highlights. You
know, I've never heard of that.
I think. So instead of, you know, watching an hour keynote or whatever, you watch, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
I did that on the one from Google last year, and it was just Sundar Pichai saying generative AI over and over again.
But then you realized it was a generative AI video.
It wasn't actually him.
All right. Time for book of the show.
Book of the show. Patrick, what's your book?
Okay, completely out of character for me, but whatever. And it ties back a bit to what I was saying, trying to kind of read sort of more academic approach and broaden my horizons, I'll call it. But this is Alice's Adventures in a Differentiable Wonderland, which I haven't made it all the way through yet. It's a little slow going for me, but it is, I think so far, it has been like a little bit of an in-between machine learning book. So you can get the sort of like elementary takes, which I feel like I kind of get. I think a lot of people are out there sort of understand at a, you know, high conceptual 30,000 foot level what's going on with, you know, the machine learning and more than just, you know, oh, it's an LLM. Like, okay, well, there's, you know, convolutional layers and there's, you know, there's this you maybe watched you know, the Three Blue One Brown, always mess up his name, video about LLMs and transformers and how they work, right? Like, you sort of understand some of the nuts and bolts from, I'll call it like the top down to about the middle. And you know, you may even could run Python scripts to train your own little model stuff I've done. But then if you flip it around and go sort of like bottom up, you know, Jason was describing this earlier, like how do you vectorize this thing I want to do and build models? Like, how do you start to piece together these things? Why do they work? What is the expectation? And then the thing that for a long time has eluded me and is maybe clued in by the title here is these, you know, ways of combining the math operations so that they're differentiable. And what does that mean? And that's basically how you get the training, how you take an effectively random set of numbers and guide them into weights that actually evoke a certain, you know, output. I'm probably using the wrong words here, but that's because I'm not trained. And so this book seems to be pretty middle of the road, which is what I'm trying to get through it. It doesn't not use any formulas, but it's also trying to explain what they're doing and where they're going. If you just jump into one of the papers, you know, transformers are all you need or whatever. Oh, no, that's not the name. Anyways, you know, you get this sort of like immediate dumping into like way too much context that I don't have. And so this book, it's a book, but it's free. It's, you know, published in a PDF. I think you can go buy a physical copy as well, but I have a link in the show notes to where you can find it, sort of kind of takes you through the various things. I'll say sort of bottoms up in this sort of middle of the road. Probably someone who has a math background, who knows computer science, but isn't a machine learning person and is trying to learn more than just here's the PyTorch commands you run, but here's what the PyTorch commands are doing or why they're doing it. What is the motivation here? Which is a big gap in where I am. So I'll take that maybe right or wrong assumption that if I'm struggling with that, maybe other people are as well. And since someone wrote a book, clearly, I guess,
yeah, this is awesome
motivation there. So,
yeah, this is so cool. I mean, this is a 300-page book totally for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is amazing. Yeah. Highly recommend it. Yeah, very cool. Okay. You got me hooked on this. I'm going to have to read this now.
He's going to ask the AI, can you read it to me, please?
Yeah. I'm going to have an AI read this to me now. Okay, my book of the show is a movie. This is also totally out of left field. I mean, you thought yours was out of left field. Wait till you hear this. It's A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the movie about Mr. Rogers. And yeah, it's a really deep movie. I mean, I actually thought it was going to be a biography, but it's not. It's a fiction movie that's based on a true story of a reporter. The reporter was basically trying to write a smear piece about Mr. Rogers, you know, one of these like muckraker kind of reporters. And he follows Mr. Rogers around. Mr. Rogers like actually like gave him permission to like, you know, follow him around and interview him and all this. And he ends up like, you know, like changing his life and everything. It's a really, really touching movie. Yeah, I highly recommend it. I think it was pretty wild, actually. It totally blew my mind. I'm generally more into like, you know, documentaries. Like I saw the one about Queen, the documentary about the band Queen. And I saw another one. So the one about Theranos, I think it's called The Dropout. I saw that. And so I went to this one just expecting another documentary, but my mind was like completely blown by this movie. So it's on Hulu, Netflix, all that good stuff. Highly recommend you check it out.
I never watched documentary. I guess I should. If it says documentary, I'm basically like instant out. Like for whatever reason, I don't know. I should probably watch them more instead of just like whatever. I don't know. It's just like, for me, I always feel like I'm going to have to do a lot of follow-up work after this documentary to like, like understand the other side or whatever. Cause it always is sort of a hot take. Right. And so,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think the ones that I've watched have been maybe not too controversial. I mean, like the Queen one, for example, it's just really interesting, like how they came up with the songs they did. And so it's really like, I think it's a way for you to have been somewhere that you weren't. You know, like I wasn't in the studio when they were recording their songs, but somebody was, and they provided insight, and you get that kind of experience, I guess, like through that. So
I will say the most impressive thing is that you said the title without any hint of sing-song in your voice.
Oh man, it's definitely a throwback to watch. Because did you watch Mr. Rogers growing up?
Yeah,
me too. It was great.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. What is your tool of the show?
Tool of the show. It's not a tool. It is a game. So it will waste your time. I would not recommend you to play this game.
You wasted so much of my time on Balatro, by the way. I beat, I think, all the chips, or I'm on the last chip.
Oh, you're better than me. I was doing so good. And then
the red and black deck is so stacked. I mean, you just have flushes whenever you want.
Yeah. Okay. People are like, what? Don't download that. Definitely don't.
Yeah, save your time.
Yeah, I have made it so that I'm only allowed to play that game when I'm on an airplane.
That's smart.
So otherwise, it's bad for me. Okay, this one's not quite so bad. This is actually a relatively short game. I guess they call these like incremental games. But someone threw this out. The other one that really killed a ton of my time was Vampire Survivors. There's like, it must be a whole thing. I don't want to know. Please don't send me emails, please. But like $3 Steam games or whatever. So this is like a $3 Steam game, supposed to be short, just goofy. But it's Dixium. And on a computer, you know, use a mouse and keyboard. On my Steam Deck, it actually works really great. A lot of the, you know, sort of like clicker games kind of don't work great on your you know, Steam Deck if you have one. But this one I did. This is how I've been playing. It actually works really great.
Do you have a touchscreen on the Steam Deck?
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
And that's what makes this game particularly so problematic for me, which is the idea is you're kind of like, I don't even know the story. It's like you're running a museum and you're going out to these various fields and digging up relics to put in your museum, and you get money for the visitors who come to your museum. It's all in not even 8-bit graphics, like Commodore 64 kind of like graphics. But you have the various places you go to harvest relics, increase in size and increase in the difficulty of mining up the dirt, and you have only so much energy to kind of mine it up. So if you're not able to sort of mine up all the blocks, you could not get all the relics that were buried in that particular round. But everything is like very quick. You know, it's maybe 5 seconds to sort of tap, 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 or click, 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 you know, clear the field, whatever, or run out of energy. You go again. And then you're also building up money in the background, and the classic, I guess, like incremental thing, you can buy upgrades and then you can reboot, you know, yourself, but some of the upgrades are permanent, and you get, for how high you get sort of permanent upgrade points that you can use before you start again. And it's just like, I know it's such a distillation of some of these incremental games. Either for me, they just like have this plateau you get to, and oh, that's the grind, and it's amazing. Yeah, I hate the grind.
Yeah,
I got that at work. I just want it to be like I was gonna say something. It's not, I guess I won't say what I was gonna. It just very like, I just want it to be light and very, you know, just a soda junk food kind of like, get me through it. I don't need it to be long lasting. I don't need it to be thoughtful. I just want to go full steam ahead and feel like I'm powerful.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, this sounds awesome. This is right up my alley.
So yeah, Dixium. I don't know if we said it, but yeah, it's available on Steam, and I don't know where else. I tried looking. It didn't look like there was other places, but definitely it's available there. It's like $3. Maybe it goes on sale sometimes. Don't know. I just paid $3, and don't do that. It's just you'll regret it. You'll spend it's actually not that long, but you know, you'll just burn a bunch of time and you'll be like, what did
so
I just
there
do?
Is an ending, right?
I believe so. I think I'm pretty close. People told me how many hours they typically spent on it. Like that's how I found it, you know, via some random link I saw somewhere. And I think I've about played that hours. And so I do get the feeling that I'm towards the end, but I don't actually know. So.
Got it. Cool. My tool of the show is a Python library called SQLite Dict, which is a weird name. It's, you know, based on the dictionary, object in Python. So, everyone doing Python has thought about this, where you have Python, you know, it's everything's a dictionary. Classes are dictionaries. You know, all the objects are dictionaries. Data classes are dictionaries. So, dictionary is like a really foundational, object, right? It's equivalent to like object in JavaScript, right? And so you're constantly passing these around. You're setting keys. You're sorting them, et cetera, et cetera. And then you always ask yourself, well, I have this dictionary. And maybe it takes like 3 hours to compute all the keys for this dictionary. And when I'm done, I want it like on disk, right? Now, if it's the kind of thing where it's a batch job, like you process this dictionary and then now you just need it on disk, you can turn any dictionary into a JSON object, a JSON string, and then write that string to disk. Pretty easy. And there's a similar function for going the other direction. There's a library called pickle where you can pickle any Python object to disk and then unpickle it later. That's great. The challenge becomes, what happens when you need kind of like a backup of a dictionary on disk, but it's like incremental? You know, it's not practical anytime this dictionary changes for you to have to save the whole thing to disk, right? So what you really need is, you start getting into the realm of like needing a database, right? Like at some point, like you want to use Redis for this or something, right? But that's pretty heavy weight. You know, you need to stand up a database, it needs to live on a port, use TCP to connect to it. It's just like a lot of work, right? You know, you could do it with Docker and stuff, but it's time consuming. So ideally, you'd have just like a file on your computer that has the dictionary on it. And you could just access that file the same way you access a regular Python dictionary. Like even, it would be even better if like you didn't have to change your code. You could just, or change a lot of your code. You could just replace, like if I have a dictionary and I'm stuffing a bunch of data into it, I could just replace that dictionary object with some other object and get a dictionary that's persisted on disk, right? And so there's something built into Python called shelve, which does this. But shelve sucks. So there's a bunch of reasons why shelve is terrible. The biggest reason is if you're on Mac or Windows, actually it might just be Windows now, but there's definitely a time where if you're on Mac or Windows, you got one database format called dumb. It's literally called dumb. And if you're on Linux, you get this other database format called DBM. So you could be on Linux using shelve, having a great time. Things are super fast. You run the same code on Mac or Windows, and it's like 300 times slower. And then you're like, well, what happened here? If you could take the time to like dive into it, you find out, oh, it's because instead of using DBM, I'm using dumb, right? So Shelve is a mess, right? There's also data corruption. So it's not that often, but sometimes if you use Shelve, when you go to open or when you go to access a key, you'll get this error, and I don't remember what it is off the top of my head, but effectively the database is corrupt and your data is gone, right? So not a big fan of Shelve. Now, SQLite is amazing. SQLite is freaking awesome. Everyone uses it. Your iPhone probably has like 30 SQLite databases running on it. That's at the OS level. Everyone's using SQLite. So SQLite Dict basically gives you the API of Shelve, but under the hood is SQLite. And, it's not going to be, it's one of these things where like, it's probably a little slower than Shelve. Maybe it's even faster than Shelve. I don't know. Probably a little slower than Shelve on Unix, but on Mac and Windows, it's the same speed as the Unix Shelve. So you don't have to worry about that. You can access the database with SQLite, in another language or stuff. It's going to be whatever you put in. So if you're pickling things and putting them in, then you're going to get just random binary garbage, right? But if you put in, let's say, a number into SQLite Dict, then you'll see a number in the database, which means you can access it from other languages and stuff. So it's an awesome library. If you're using Shelve, stop using it. Use this thing instead. If you're not using any of these, it's another sort of tool in the toolbox that I go to pretty often.
I've heard so many issues with pickle. So yeah, I think putting it, even if it's tedious to get the stuff back out, I guess like having something that's SQLite that other, programming languages, whatever, can access other programs, like feels like a win.
Yeah. I mean, by default, Shelve and SQLite will both, what they'll do is they'll look at the data type of what you're trying to put into the dictionary. And if it's a primitive data type, it'll just store it. If you try to put like a Python class into the dictionary, both of them will pickle it. And I totally agree. I think instead of trying to throw Python classes into either of these, you should like convert to JSON or something like that. Pickle is good if you're in a hurry. But yeah, I think there's security issues. You really have to trust the person who pickled the object. And then also there's weirdness around like if you change the class and all of that.
Very cool. Well, guess what time it is?
It is project planning and management time.
I was going to say thank the Patreon times, but yes.
Oh, thank you, Patreons. That's awesome.
I'm teasing. All right. Thank you to all our Patreons. But yes, it is actually time to talk about project planning. And then we realized maybe a little bit of management. I'll give the disclosure. This is not advice. This is just entertainment. No, I'm just kidding. we are software engineers. Both. We are not product managers. We are not project managers. We are not like, this is just from a sweet perspective. It's a very casual conversation. So, trying to give people the sort of vibe, I guess this is what the cool kids seem to say, the vibe of what this project planning is all about, and there are things to think about and the, stuff to go on. And we're going to jump right in to start motivating the reason why. Although, maybe if you took a second, you'd probably get most of these. But the reason to plan your projects, I guess, is to think about the alternative if you don't have a plan. If you work in a company or on a medium or large size project, anything that's, going to take more than just a couple hours, really having a plan is important. And, I think there's a bunch of reasons why, but some of it is that having a explicit process where you kind of go and plan what you're doing allows other people to give feedback on the plan, right? Make sure your coworkers are aware, make sure everybody's sort of gathered together, and to figure out, hey, what parts of the plan are going to be risky? Hey, we're going to do this by this date, but there's a holiday break here. So if everybody goes on holiday break, then, we're not going to get our plan done, or we're going to have to try this new technology or this new algorithm we don't, yet know how to do. And making sure that sometimes you have blind spots and that people identify, hey, what are you sort of not counting seriously enough?
Yeah, totally agree. I think another really important part of project planning is headcount planning. And this is something where I've seen this go horribly wrong, even at big companies. I definitely am not going to give any personal stories, although I'm thinking a bunch in my head. But I've seen situations where people who asked for, you know, managers who asked for more headcount just got it, just for asking. And it's like, if you didn't ask, you didn't get it. Or I've seen cases where it was pretty subjective. It's like, oh, your project is kind of cool, let's like put more people on it, right? But ultimately, like, the principled, objective way to do this is you should plan, like, what is the expected amount of work that our team is going to accomplish? And when you say team, this could be thousands of people, it could be four people, it still works. And then come up with like a distribution. And maybe, like, you know, this is like science brain of me, but come up with like a distribution where, you know, if you're like one sigma below the distribution, then like that was slightly below expectations. You know, if I'm one sigma above the distribution, that's above expectations. And then that's really important for so many reasons. One is, you know, at the end of the year, you need to figure out, did my team perform at my expectations or not? And you can't do that if you don't set expectations, right? But the second thing is you get to see what you didn't do. At the end of the day, like, adding more people allows you to do things you couldn't do. And you have to know what that is before you can make a case for more people. So, you know, at the end of the year, we could say, you know, here's a list of ideas we had. Look, this idea, we didn't do it, and someone else did it, and they published a paper, and that paper was amazing. So, like, that's a miss, you know? Or, you know, here we had a list of ideas. We didn't get to any of them, but it turns out they were all kind of, like, maybe not that good. Like it was all below the fold, and we're actually not really missing out on not hiring people. So I think, you know, headcount planning is really kind of, like, dovetails nicely into this.
Thinking about, you know, expanding from headcount, not just new hires or, you know, allocation of people, but also making sure if there's other teams upstream or downstream of your work, and that there's a dependency, either like, hey, we are going to use this thing that isn't being used today, or we're going to assume this thing another team is creating is going to be available. It's very important to communicate so much. I mean, it's so obvious, but just in life, how many things can be solved by just, you know, communication? And so making sure that you communicate expectations around headcount, expectations around, we're going to talk about schedule, but also, you know, thinking through what are the dependencies between modules, and sort of the APIs that I want to call or depend on downstream, upstream. If you are going to use a third-party service, pricing, right? Like, am I going to be sensitive to if the prices go up on these function calls down for me or API calls? You know, is that going to be a problem? And sort of making sure you have that. And then when we start to talk about schedule and thinking about, you know, depending on stuff that's not yet available or how much it's going to take for you to get your sort of modules or work, you know, implemented, work items implemented, there's also identifying the sort of critical path, what both from terms of the data flow, but also in terms of from your schedule standpoint, what is the sort of thing that if you walk through the schedule, that is, these are the items, and some items are happening in parallel, but these are items we expect to take longest. And if we sort of line them all up, this is the sort of length, and it's the set of things that we are most sensitive to in the final schedule, right? These are the set of things where if we get behind or we aren't able to handle the risks, or, you know, something slips, then our, you know, total schedule will slip. And that's very important to, and maybe everything is on that path. That's entirely possible. But if there are things off of that path, I would argue actually knowing that they're off of the path is as important as knowing what's on the path. Because when it's off the path, you have a little bit more flexibility. You have a little bit more sort of dynamicism, you know, that Jason was mentioning, thinking about things as a distribution. If you start to get involved and you find out you're needing more resources from, you know, than you, the sort of median was, then, you know, you can kind of pull them from things that were less important maybe, right? And if you sort of, you know, kind of understand which things have which priority, there's that classic, I guess, kind of joke. Everything is the most important, but if everything's the most important, nothing's important.
Right.
And every company seems to fail at this. This is fine. It's just like a difficult thing, but you can't say everything is equally important because you really do need to know if something's going to slip, where's it going to come from? Where are we going to pull things? And having that thought through and communicated is very vital.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. One thing that I, you know, if I could impart any wisdom at all, it would be, I always underestimate the ripple effects from decisions that I make in the workplace and maybe just universally. I think it's just really hard to measure multi-order effects because usually what you're trying to do is you have your own plan. Like, I want to try and build this, and then I want to try and write this paper, and then that paper is like a stepping stone to this other project, and then I have this idea, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. And so you're like, you're doing what DeepSeek is doing, right? And it's hard to do that and think about like all the ripple effects of like, okay, if we're late on this project, that causes this other team to do this, which causes other team to do that. Or even like, an even better example is like, given that we're late on this project, if you communicated that now versus next week, that actually can result in totally different outcomes. Even though it was the same, you know, the same effect, the same initial effect could have two totally different outcomes depending on when it was communicated. And these are really difficult things to measure.
Yeah, I think the interconnectivity, we can talk about the mythical man month. We can talk about the classic, you know, hey, if I just give you another person, can you go twice as fast? But I mean, a lot of that comes down to what you're saying is like, it is very difficult, human software engineers, to understand just how much impact one decision, one choice, one slip, one whatever can have, and the sort of compounding you get from that.
Yeah, totally. It's definitely like a bullwhip effect where, you know, especially if you're at like if you're doing research, you're kind of like at the beginning of the bullwhip. And so if you kind of make a bad decision or you don't try to advance something or whatever, then that causes like this massive swings downstream.
So that's actually great use of that term. Can you maybe, but can you kind of explain what the bullwhip effect is?
Yeah, so I believe this came out of like supply chain management, but the idea is, you know, let's say you end up with slightly less grain this season. Well, then people will start, you know, people downstream of that will start to experience shortages, and they'll start to, you know, buy up volume and do different things to like handle those shortages. And so then some of those processes that they start implementing, like buying extra surplus, doing all these extra things, they'll continue next year even when you don't have a shortage. So they're kind of like, because they're downstream of you, they're reacting to you and their reactions are very quick. And so they end up like buying more than they need. And then next year you have a surplus and they're still buying more than they need. And so now they have to like double correct. And so it just has this compounding effect, right? And that's just one step. So imagine if there's a supply chain with like 20 steps, the person 20 steps down is just experiencing like wild volatility because of all of these kind of like mispredictions. Did I get that right?
Yeah. So if you think about like software that is finally delivered or a product that ends up on a shelf on a store, and you think about all the unique steps that it takes to get there, and especially when they're sort of like a continuous process, which we could kind of talk about software being viewed as a sort of one shot or continuous. But yeah, it's just sort of like as you add these dependency things, small perturbations in the beginning, if you sort of like, if everybody sort of stacks it up, they get compounding. And so, yeah, I think that can definitely be there. And when you talk about, and I think we were going to maybe talk about the end, but you know, I think it makes sense now, is if everybody sort of tries to, and you were sort of saying like overbuy or have buffer or allocate a little extra, right? And so if you take all of the teams and all of the steps and everybody sort of buffers up so that, you know, they're not the ones called out, you end up with something that's really like 4 or 5x longer or more expensive than it needs to be, because you end up with all this hidden sort of like padding that occurs all over the place. And so you'll hear that like upper management will sometimes say, you know, like, I, whatever they tell me, I cut it in half, or I cut it in 20%. Or, and this is what they're talking about. And it happens with budgets, it happens with headcount, it happens with schedule, where everybody sort of pads, and then the people over them pad, and then the people over them pad, and you end up with like ridiculous amounts of padding. And so there is this element when you're doing project planning of trust, right? That you need to be actually honest. And there's already difficult enough to even estimate how long something's going to take. If you're not, if you're sort of also playing this game of politicizing it. Now, does that actually happen? No, I think everybody politicizes it to some extent.
Sure.
But, you know, the less of it that you can have, the better, which is, hey, you're brutally honest with your manager, they're brutally honest with their manager, and you have an actual view up and down the chain of what's happening. And just like we talked about the bullwhip effect, unfortunately, it only takes one of those links or one of those layers to be, I don't want to say like a bad actor, but to just try to make sure, like, I'm definitely not going to be the one who is called out, and they sort of add something. How at the top are you supposed to know, you know, how honest all of the estimates, all of the work is? And so, yeah, the bullwhip effect can be unintentional, but I will say it also works kind of in this sort of like intentional safety that people add, sort of aggravates the effect even more.
Yeah, totally right. I think that, you know, that's a good point. I mean, sort of a meta point here is like, you know, I see people who transition from an individual contributor to a manager, and they start off with like, okay, how can everything be perfect? Like, how do I make everybody's task done? What do I have to do to kind of like rewrite history so that like everything we set out to do in March, we now have accomplished, you know, next year. And everyone on my team is perfect. They all need to get promoted all the time. And then over time you start like calibrating, and you say, okay, like the goal actually isn't to like play the organization system as if it's Monopoly or something, right? The goal is to like have the most accurate assessment of the situation. And so, I mean, you know, the earlier example of like, put things on your plan that you feel unlikely that you're going to accomplish. And then when you don't accomplish those, that's normal. Like you should set your team up so that there's like an upper and a lower bound that they can achieve. And you know, statistically, you will eventually have a quarter where your team massively underperforms. Like that's how it's going to work statistically. You're going to draw that short straw, you know, so many times in your life, right? And so, I think project planning also helps keep people from panicking. It's like, you know, yeah, we missed this quarter, but you know, we didn't miss the past three quarters, and so this is natural, and so we pick it up next quarter.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great transition to goal setting, but I think it becomes almost a parody, a joke, when you see people who set goals and then they always get exactly the goal, or like exactly the goal plus some like little fudge factor, and it's always slightly more, like I always accomplished 1.03 of whatever my metric was. And it's like, if you never come under your goal, to your point, you actually don't have the distribution set correctly. Like it should be 50-50. Sometimes you're over and sometimes you're under, and that's life. And that actually means you have the sort of estimates well set. And if you don't, you're just sort of like goofing around, gaming the system, under whatever, you know, like at least that's sort of my opinion. I mean, maybe you're in some, you know, hockey stick growth thing, and it actually is just really, really difficult to predict. That can happen. But setting goals is very critical. And I think also being flexible and not saying, which we've can sometimes happen, the plan isn't there to say, oh, we've ruined the beautiful plan. You know, plans never encounter the first, you know, never survive the first encounter with, you know, real life or the enemy, or, you know, use whatever your favorite, you know, quote there I'm butchering. But I think the plan is there to help give people the feeling that like, no, it's okay. We have these things written down. We have them documented. We know what to go adjust, who to go tell, what is going to be impacted, not, oh my gosh, you've ruined all of our work. And I very dislike working in situations where people are like, we made the plan and now the plan is ruined. And it's like, well, then there's probably not a good plan. Like the purpose of the plan is to help us, not hurt us. But on setting goals, you know, there's a mnemonic that you'll hear, which is set your goals to be SMART.
Yeah, totally. My favorite quote is the Mike Tyson one, where he says, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face."
Oh, there you go. There you go. Yeah, yeah.
So SMART goals stands for that. The acronym SMART is specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound. And so if you've ever taken any kind of project management course in any of your work, you'll hear this come up.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, again, maybe it feels a bit obvious. It's actually really useful if you have set goals and you actually ask yourself personal goals, project plan goals, but, you know, have you done all of these things? I often find that, oh yeah, despite the fact that when you say it this way, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, I often screw up at least two of them, I'll say. It's very rare that without very intentional work that you meet all of these.
Yep. And I think the two most important are the measurable and the time bound. So time bound is almost a no-brainer, right? I mean, that one, I think everyone's like, well, when's task X going to be done? But the measurable one, that is the one where I often catch people and have to iterate. So someone will say, for example, like, build the foo widget, right? And so we all have to agree that just building the foo widget is a good thing, you know, and that happens sometimes, right? But generally, I'll push back and say, okay, like, well, what is the point of the foo widget? You know, like, here's a company, you know, KPIs, here's a company, you know, metrics, right? Do we need to create a new metric? Like, is this a new dimension that we need to be looking at? And you know, it might be that, you know, we're going to create the foo thing, the foo widget, and then we're going to have like a list of things we're going to measure on the foo widget. And so then you can like distill down to the goal. So if you're creating the foo widget because you have a new sort of segment of customers, right? What are those customers going to do? Well, they're going to buy the foo widget. How much does a foo widget cost? It costs $20. Okay, so we have a goal that, you know, we're going to make like $100,000 in the first 3 months selling this foo widget that we haven't built yet. Like there should be some way to get it down to a measurable thing where you're not measuring like, yeah, the thing is built. That's one. Or the thing is not built. That's zero. You know, like getting a proper measurement that like connects to the company's objective and all of that, I think is really important. So you know, sometimes you might build things, you know, and you see this a lot in research, like you build things that are trying to kind of push the industry in a new direction. And even in these cases, there should be some way to measure, even if it's an internal benchmark or something like that. Maybe instead of building the foo widget, what you need to build is the benchmark that you're expecting the foo widget to outperform in. And we need to actually build that thing. Because otherwise, someone will build the foo widget, they'll be super proud of it, and then they're wondering like why their performance review wasn't good. You know? So it's like, well, you have to build the thing. Sometimes you have to build the thing that motivates or explains the efficacy of the actual thing. And so the measurable one is super key. You know, the other ones I feel are, you know, like specific. It's kind of like, okay, everyone should always be specific. Achievable, it's like, how could you have a non-achievable goal? But the measurable and the time bound seem the ones that really stick with me.
You've never had your manager set a non-achievable goal?
So
if so, you've been incredibly lucky.
So I feel like I have to be diplomatic. I've definitely had managers set non-achievable goals, but not once have I ever said this goal is unachievable and they've said, okay, we'll change it. So it seems almost like I do think that achievable goals are more achievable, but I don't think that knowing that is going to help you get a impossible goal and make it achievable. Like I've seen, one time they wanted this metric to go up by some ungodly amount. And I basically was saying, like, you know, it's not really going to happen. And what ended up happening was the metric went up by a nominal amount, and then everyone was kind of meh about it. So the fact that the goal is unachievable, I don't know if it really changed anything.
Well, then I think that's the point of the sort of letters working together. Like if it being unachievable didn't matter, I mean, I think that's because it wasn't a good goal. Like you could have had a better goal that would have helped people rally around it or would have done something slightly different. And maybe it could have been at least 2x of whatever the nominal increase is, maybe not 1,000x, sure. But like it being more achievable could have been potentially more motivating to people because there could have been a path to it.
Yeah, I mean, this is tough, right? So if someone sets a really ambitious goal, that gets people excited. You know, it gets their managers excited. It gets your team really excited. And then if you are directionally accurate and you do make an improvement, but it wasn't like the enormous outstanding improvement, it's really tough. I mean, like your instinct is to say, well, I expected, let's say, a 2-4x improvement. My director promised a 400x improvement. We got a 3x improvement. Like your instinct is to say, like, yeah, that was like a giant mess up. Like the head honcho should have just predicted a 4x improvement. But then it's like, when I look back on it, it's like that like fake number caused so much excitement. It's like, it's kind of like a counterintuitive thing. It actually worked out. I don't know. This gets really complicated, but I guess if it's measurable, then maybe that just makes it at least somewhat achievable. I don't know.
All right. Well, let's just keep going. I think, you know, talking about other things about that work here, we're talking about identifying the critical path. You'll hear this. And I think the concept is really, really solid. I think people can often, and you know, as we're kind of saying here, I think people can take things for unintended reasons or take them too far. But one of the things is Gantt charts. So if you sort of represent each of the tasks as a sort of, I guess, like a rectangle, a bubble, and you sort of schedule them over time and you sort of draw interdependencies, it kind of sounds stupid, but you often will discover like we have work scheduled to begin before the thing that it is needing at input finishes.
Right.
Oh, well, that is not going to work. And if you just sort of say, hey, you know, to do B, we need A. A is going to finish in Q1. We're going to start B in, you know, February. It's like, well, wait a minute. Like, are you going to be able to do work? And then you would say, well, you know, we can start it. Well, then it's really probably two tasks, like getting ready and then executing, right? And so it helps you to decompose them, which again, then helps with what we talked about earlier, you know, headcount, Slack, buffering, understanding what's critical and not critical. And so putting up a Gantt chart is a way to sort of say, and in some ways, you know, not the right use, but work backwards and say, hey, we really need this to be done by this date. If we really put all the processes in place and say, you know, when do we think we need them? And sometimes you realize, oh, actually, we need to start this a lot sooner than we thought. And then you say, oh, we don't have the right personnel. And that's always a very delicate thing to balance, which is, hey, you may need 10 people in the beginning and only 2 people at the end. Is there a way for us to be thoughtful and make it so that, you know, we have a more level headcount throughout, because it's very difficult to need 10 people and then just get rid of them. Ramping up is generally easy. Ramping down can be a bit more difficult. And so is there tasks that aren't in this dependency chain that we can reschedule or reallocate and you know, sort of make it a little bit more palatable? And so Gantt charts are a very specific way of sort of identifying the interconnectivity between the tasks and the schedule.
Yep, that makes sense. A couple of, like, you'll hear these methodologies get thrown around, like Scrum, Agile, Waterfall. And I have to confess, like, they all occupy some, like, really nebulous part of my brain where, like, it all just kind of flows together like one of these, like, really weird text-to-image things. If you put in, like, you know, a theory of mind into a text-to-image generator, you just get garbage. So I don't quite understand the different nuances and differences there. I'll just say my piece on it. And then Patrick, you probably have a lot more experience. I generally feel like you should just consistently be replanning. So, you know, in my case, like right now, for example, you know, I have a weekly planning meeting at my current job. And so we look at the last week's plan and, you know, the quarterly plan and how are things trending. And I just think it's really important to stay kind of on top of your plan and just discuss it every week. And then also have like a very quick touch base every day of like, hey, how are things going? What's the roadblocks? What are the barriers? What are the accomplishments? And just, you know, kind of touch base. And beyond that, I haven't really found any of these like acronym or any of these words like Scrum or Agile to be particularly useful.
I think it's one of those like people are surprised when I talk about it. In general, it has been my experience in talking to a lot of other people that I work with and around, that the sort of Silicon Valley tech companies are, I don't know, like a bit unique in a couple of ways, where they try to hire people that are very talented. They try to hire people who aren't hyper specialized by default. They generally prefer people who are flexible more than specialized. And their customers are like end shipping products and not, you know, pay for, you know, accomplishments and milestones. So you'll hear about, even internally, we'll talk about like setting milestones. If you worked where you were contracting for another company to deliver something and they weren't going to pay you all the money up front without knowing that it was done, and you need to pay your engineers, so you can't take all the money at the end when you finished. So you need milestones. Those milestones need to be evaluated. I think you get a lot more process heavy, culture, which is completely makes sense. Silicon Valley is a little different in that people can kind of tackle many, many of the different tasks that are within a project. They may be better or worse, but they try to be generally less specialized than maybe in other industries. And the fact that most of the stuff is all what is internally funded, they're not doing it against a contract. They're just internally trying to do research and try to make the product better and ship metrics. So all the goal setting is internally motivated rather than tied to dollar amounts that occur for incremental progress. It's sort of the end outcomes that matter and nothing along the way. It's just sort of like get it done, leads to a more flexible, dynamic, less stricture around sort of following this methodology. But if you look at like defense contractors or people doing contract software for other companies, you end up with a lot more of these. And there are good ways of doing them and bad ways and pros and cons of each of them. But in the end, a lot of it is dictated by how the money is going to flow from the person paying for the work to the people doing the work. And so I also have very little experience. I can't talk about, you know, pros and cons of various ways of doing these things, because in general, I would say we are, like Jason is sort of saying, it's a sort of continuous process where we're doing this, but it's not very formalized. It's a very informal process. And you rely heavily on everyone generally being aligned towards the same goal. And acutely, we'll see when people on the team aren't aligned to the same goal, it's actually problematic that there's none of these processes in place. When everyone is aligned and has the right incentives, it's actually amazing, because you don't end up with any of the overhead that these processes would have. And so it's sort of a, I don't know, pick your poison kind of thing. I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's worse. It's just very different.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess, okay, maybe we could distill the few sort of like key components to all of these methods. Generally, you know, when you're doing any type of project planning, you have a backlog. So the backlog are, you know, ideas that you've thought up, but you're not ready to work on. Typically, you'll get a lot of tasks assigned to you from other teams or other members of your team. And then you have your, you know, current things that you're working on, and the Gantt chart that Patrick mentioned and all of that associated with that. And then you have things that are, you've basically committed to, like, these are things that we're definitely going to do. And maybe you even have dates on those, but they're not in progress. And so effectively what you're doing on a weekly basis is you're looking at your backlog. You're saying, like, are there things that we should add to this backlog? Like, have people thought of new things? There's derivative work. Is there a task that needs to be split and that second part needs to go in the backlog? And then you're also assigning sort of like a rough amount of work to the things that are in the backlog. Like, is this a really large task, a tiny task? And then what's the priority? So you're trying to prioritize that backlog even before you start pulling things up. And then, you know, depending on the job, you know, I've worked different jobs where sometimes like in research, things are really staggered, right? Because you have all these different conferences and they all have different deadlines. So like, so the person who wants to submit to ICML, they're on a totally different schedule than a person who wants to submit to NeurIPS, because those conferences have different deadlines. If you're not dealing with like kind of that kind of world, then you can maybe have something more regular where, you know, at the end of the quarter, the entire team does a retrospective of the whole quarter. You know, that's something that can work if you're in a less heterogeneous environment. But I think, you know, so two big pieces of advice for project planning, and this is important whether you are a project manager, an individual contributor, a manager, et cetera, you know, is look backwards just as often as you look forward so you can kind of calibrate yourself. You know, have a weekly meeting where you kind of go through those different states of your tasks, and then also make sure that you're putting new ideas down. I've seen a trap where people will just get into bug fixing mode and kind of forget to innovate. And so sometimes you have to put a bug on hold so you can innovate. And again, that's, if people are upset about that, that's when you go back and say, well, this gets back to headcount planning, right? I've seen it a lot in research where, you know, research idea becomes production server, and then all of a sudden, like, ooh, it becomes total project planning chaos. And these are all steps that will help mitigate that.
Quickly, just cover some of the tools that you might hear that are associated with this. My favorite is Whiteboard. And then I had to clarify because it sounded like it was a product name, but just like an actual like whiteboard and people in a room standing around and quickly like it, you know, and we talked about work from home from last time, but I will say one of the things that most I think can be difficult without just being there and like on a piece of paper or on a whiteboard is just that real iterative dynamicism that happens very early in the process specifically, or, you know, when you're really under a lot of change. The digital tools, for me at least, are just, they're not as easy to kind of just like put up something, draw it, redraw the arrow, move it here, move it there. You know, you're trying to, the tool forces a certain behavior versus you kind of just want it to be, at least for stuff I do, you know, a little more free flowing in that early project planning stage.
If only someone made a really, really large e-ink tablet, like 4 by 6 feet.
Like the size of a whiteboard, but it's e-ink.
Yeah. This is all I want, please. Some factory in
what you need is like modular e-ink panels, like with magnets on the side. You could just like build your own, put a bezel on it, stitch them together, whatever.
That would be amazing. Yeah, whiteboarding, really important, really useful. How do you use a whiteboard since you're remote, Patrick?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for it. Occasional like on-site visits is a good way. Okay. To try to accomplish that. And planning, when done right, I mean, doesn't that kind of stuff doesn't need to be done super, super frequently. I mean, updates to the plan, sure, but you know, that sort of initial stuff doesn't happen quite as often. But I mean, there are, you know, digital whiteboards that you can erase and draw on and scribble. For some reason, they're just never quite as clean as the whiteboard. Oh, here's the bonus in real life one, Post-it notes.
Oh yeah, Post-it notes plus whiteboard.
Yeah. Okay. Those are my two. Okay. You can move on to the more serious tools.
I mean, I've used all of these. They're okay. You know, Jira, Asana, Open Project. These are all names that you'll hear. I'm sure there are other ones too that I can't remember, but you know, all of them more or less do the same thing. I mean, if I had to recommend one, I would recommend Jira because it's free. You can have, I think, one or two projects for free. So if you're a student out there, I know the majority of our listeners are students. Just use Jira. It's free. You know, the interface is a little clunky. You know, Asana, I would say, is a slightly better interface, but Is it worth the price? If you're a student, probably not. If you're a professional, then matters less, the cost of it. They're all great projects. They'll all help you. And they all have all sorts of integrations. So you can get like a Slack message or an email whenever there's a new task and all of that good stuff.
So we talked a little bit about the dealing with uncertainty. There was one more tool. I don't know anything about that Open Project. Do you know, is that, that's a...
Open Project is an open source kind of like Jira equivalent. And so if you, you know, there's times where like going open source just feels kind of cool, or you might just be feeling like, I really don't want to depend on any service or anything. And I did run Open Project sometime in the past, and it was pretty good. I mean, it had a lot of the same features, and it's your code. You can totally edit it and do whatever you want with it. If you are like really into project planning to where you want to sort of like hack on the project planner itself, then you could use Open Project.
Oh, we also didn't cover, but one you may hear a term is Kanban. And it's really sort of like in all of this stuff, but you know, there are many, many tools for doing Kanban boards. But those are more or less having tasks on little boxes or post-it notes and columns and sort of moving them for just trying to get into that low overhead understanding that situations are dynamic and a sort of visual representation of it. But the final thing to just talk about is, you know, I guess to continue Jason's quote, what happens when you get punched in the face? Somebody gets sick, the goalposts get moved, whatever, you know, sort of happens, and your plan is no longer a sort of working. And we talked about making sure that you do have some padding, some buffering, specifically around things that are harder to schedule. Like, you know, Jason keeps talking about research, and I think that's very difficult because it's sometimes very hard to put a specific time on when you're going to have that innovation or when it's going to occur. And so making sure you have buffering in the schedule can prevent it. But again, once you get punched in the face, it isn't really there. But making sure that everyone's very communicative and on the same, you know, space, and that, you know, being really honest with management that there needs to be slack in the schedule to say, hey, we're going to have issues. We don't want to, you know, have everything booked, you know, end to end to end, no downtime, no slack. Like, that's just a way to have the, you know, expectations get missed. And then once they are missed, being honest, like for me, not everyone does it, but I try to be very clear when we're no longer tracking to schedule. A lot of people try to hide it and we'll make it up. I'm a big believer of, let's move the schedule, and if we make it up, we'll move it back. And that doesn't make me always popular with people, but stuff generally gets done. And as you get closer and closer, the certainty of that final date is more nailed down. And you don't always, all situations aren't flexible like that. But for me, that's a huge thing, is just saying, listen, that end date is going to move. It will move less the closer we get, but we should move it to be accurately reflecting of what's actually happening.
Yeah, totally agree. I think that we covered this already, but there's a short-term gain. I won't lie. I think there is a short-term gain in fudging the numbers, making your plan in hindsight look like incredibly prophetic, and, you know, trying to like sell some Cinderella story about your team. Like, you could probably do that, especially if like your manager is also pretty junior. Like, you could get away with that, but it will fall apart. It is not a long-term strategy that is going to work. Eventually, the chickens will come home to roost after you get punched in the face, and all the other analogies. But, you know, just being upfront, and you can end up at an impasse where, you know, you feel like this set of goals is nominal, is expected, and your team disagrees, or maybe a single person on your team says, you know, this is way more than I can accomplish. And those are very difficult conversations, which makes the project planning even more important. So that, you know, at the end, you know, and this is not something that people like to talk about, but, you know, if you do have a person who's just not performing and you have to have some really hard conversations, you can say, look, like, here's the plan we set out. There was disagreement about the plan, but, you know, the rest of the team, you know, feels like this was a very reasonable plan that somebody could do in a reasonable amount of time, and that person didn't do it. And so we have to, you know, have a performance discussion. So being able to do all of that planning up front and have those, you know, hard conversations up front is super important. And it will help give you sort of like a long-term sustainable team. All right. I think that about wraps it up. Do you have any parting thoughts before we hit the road, Patrick?
Just reiterating my disclaimer. Nothing we said. No, I'm just kidding. yeah, I mean, everybody does it, whether you want to or not. Informal, formal, like somewhere on the sort of gradient from nothing to overdoing it. But you know, project planning. If you are going to have a kid, if you're going to get married, if you're going to like projects and planning happens, and you know, you can either sort of I don't sound bad, blunder through it, or you can, you know, try to pick the best pieces that work for your situation, and really try to have it be something that, you know, maybe is not your expertise but isn't a weakness. And so I think there's a lot of self-learning that can occur by planning things and then looking back and saying like, hey, they didn't go according to plan. That's okay. But like, you know, this was my plan. And sometimes a plan can be a little bit more audacious and, you know, be inspirational. But, you know, maybe you got to be real that it's that. But, you know, sometimes you're right. Like, I think, you know, in my personal life, I just try to say like, hey, I'm going to have a plan for the year. And at the end of the year, look back and say, like, hey, did I hit or miss? Right. And so, not to get deeply philosophical, I guess, but you know, I think planning and goal setting and projects is something that really goes across sort of all the things we do.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is there's a other side of this, which is celebrate when your team does awesome. You know, I've seen a lot of managers forget to do that. They're sort of like almost afraid of the first thing I said. They're afraid of like people think, oh, we're sandbagging or whatever. But like, look back and say like, wow, we set out to do 5 things. We did 6 things. They're all awesome. And we should throw a party and get sushi for everyone or something.
Ooh, oh man, now I'm hungry.
Oh man, now I want sushi. All right, we will let everyone go. Super shout out. Thank you to our patrons. We really appreciate y'all's support. And now we should all go get some sushi.
See you next time.
Catch you later.